Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Jesse Green here at the control panels as always, and today in episode 117, I'm delighted to be joined by Jerry Jones from jerryjonesdirect.com. Jerry's background is really unique. He's owned dental practices even though he's not a dentist, but his real background is in marketing, and he's quite expert at filling appointment books and keeping them full, meaning the ability to attract and retain patients in a practice. We have a wide-ranging conversation about Jerry's experience as a practice owner and as a marketer and the things he's learned along the way, some of the things he wished he'd learned earlier, and we all do. We have our lessons and we have our wins, and Jerry is very frank when he shares what worked well with him and some of the things he may have done differently. It's a really useful interview for anyone in dental practice. No matter what stage you're up to in your business, there's something in here for you. So as always, have a pen and paper handy because I know you're going to want to take some notes so you can apply them directly to your practice. Now, for those people who are new to the podcast, you may not know, but we have a Savvy Dentist Facebook group. It's the companion Facebook group to this podcast. It's a dentist-only Facebook group, and we'd love to welcome you into that community where we share tips, training, some tactics, and ultimately a sense of community. So come on over, join us there. If you head to drjessegreen.com/Facebook, you'll find us there. So without any further ado, however, I'd love you to have a listen to Jerry Jones. And as I said earlier, have your pen and paper handy because you're going to want to take some notes. Here he is. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. And today I'm delighted to be joined by fellow podcaster Jerry Jones, who runs the Jerry Jones Radio Show, coming all the way from Salem in Oregon. How are you, Jerry?
I am fantastic. It's an honor and a privilege to be on your podcast. And I've listened to a couple of your episodes. I've read your book, which, by the way, before we even get started, if there's a dentist listening to this that has not read your book for some reason, they need to read it, because what you cover on retention is like, that's like the hidden secret in dentistry that nobody talks about. I was so excited to see that a dentist understood it and was actually writing about it. It was really cool. So just a plug for your book right out of the gate.
Well, thank you, mate. That's the quickest one I've had yet, but I really appreciate that. And the thing is, I really appreciate meeting a kindred spirit more than anything, Jerry, because, you know, I know you've written on the subject of marketing and all sorts of different kinds of marketing, but I also know that you're a big fan of retention and making sure the dentists retain their patient base. So it is always nice to meet a kindred spirit in that regard. Jerry, I wanted to just talk a little bit about your backstory, because it is really rather fascinating. People generally don't end up in this line of work in a linear fashion. There's usually a few zigs and zags in the career path. I'm curious to understand your journey. How did you get to the point? Because you're so well known in marketing circles, and I know you help lots of doctors in the States with their marketing, but how did you get to that point? What's been your path to this point?
It's been a wild ride for sure. I think I'm marking year 23 coming up here in just a few months. In the last 15 years, I've spent as a dental practice owner, which is kind of odd because I'm not a dentist. And here in the States, it's not customary for non-dentists to own practices. In many states, it's illegal. In the state of Oregon, it's actually illegal to own a dental practice. And so I owned a dental office. I know, isn't that clever?
Oh, wow.
One word change, right? It had to do with patient files. I just couldn't own patient files. And so I was more than happy to let the dentist own the files, and I ran the practice, or the office rather. But so it's been weird and crazy. But 15 years ago, I'd been in on the marketing side of dentistry for a number of years, and I kept running into doctors who would just tell me about how frustrated they were with their staff and with managing the practice and with, you know, getting new patients in the door and keeping their patients. And I mean, it was just, you know, one doctor after another, the same thing over and over again. I thought, I know we're getting them results. I know our marketing is producing calls for them. they didn't track the phone calls and they didn't score the, you know, they, this is back when call tracking numbers didn't exist. So intuitively knew that we were, you know, getting them business, but they just always had an excuse. And so I thought, I will get a lot out of opening a new business that would be a dental office, because I could learn A, what these challenges are firsthand, how to solve them. And B, I could find out if my marketing really was working. And so 5, 6 years, 7 years into it, I thought, I'm going to open a dental office. And so I went out and literally no patients, no doctor, no staff. I mean, I didn't have anything except for, a suite, an office suite full of equipment and a $250,000 investment to boot. So, I mean, I didn't have much of a choice to make it work or not. I mean, I had to make it work. So, you know, just pure grit for the first couple of years. And lo and behold, all the complaints that dentists had about managing a practice and the contents within were, in fact, a giant pain in the butt.
And you got to experience it firsthand.
I did, yes. And it was, and so, I mean, I got a lot out of it. I got a lot out of it, because, I mean, just literally a couple weeks ago, I signed the sales agreement and cashed a big fat check selling my office. So
congratulations.
Thank you. It was a great, I feel so light, you know, it's like, not to get too far off the track already, but yesterday our city had a water quality alert. So we had blue-green algae in our drinking water source. And so the entire city can't use the water today, literally today, the day we're recording this. So you can't drink the water. I mean, you know, you can, but you'll probably get sick. And if you're young or old or infirm, you know, you'll probably die and all that kind of stuff. And so this morning I got up and I said to my wife, you know, it's a really nice feeling not to have to think about or even give two shits about what that dental office is going through this morning, wondering what they're going to do about water. You know, it was like, oh man, it's such a nice feeling not to have a dental assistant send me a text message telling me they're quitting or they're pregnant or the hygienist wants to go find another job or the doctors are pissed off about it. So sorry about all my expletives.
Yeah, you go for it. Yeah, you be you. That's all good.
I do cuss once in a while, but it's just been so nice. And so I really appreciate both sides, you know, having started it and what it takes to start an office and grow a practice, and even grow through the recession. We had like 25 to 28% growth from 2007 all the way into like 2011. So, I mean, we had this tremendous growth even. You know, we ended up, we had one time, I think I had 4 doctors there working all sorts of hours and 10 or 15 staff. I don't even remember. It's a good memory to not have in a lot of cases. So it's been a weird and wild, you know, way to get here. I mean, I started working for a dentist not too far out of college. He had a newsletter that was sold to dentists and he was looking for an editor. And so I hired on as an editor for a financial newsletter that was targeted at dentists. And a few, you know, like a year later, I ended up buying a piece of the company. It was just through, you know, strange happenings, and ended up taking a piece of the business that was struggling and turned it into a nice business. I sold it to one of my employees a few years later. And then a few years after that, I ended up getting back into it again because the gentleman that bought it from me, who it just wasn't a good fit for him. He went on to start another business that did fantastically well. So 17, 18 businesses bought, sold, or started over the last, you know, 22 years. So it's been crazy. A dental assisting school I had at one point, that was an interesting business. Also involved in 2 other dental offices. So an ownership in 2 other dental offices. So it's been just a fascinating journey. And so here I am now for the first time in, I think since I was telling my mom this, the first time since I was 14, I only have 1 job. So, you know, it's like 1 job, that's easy. I could do that in like an hour a day, right? So,
yeah, I know. How relaxing.
Yeah, I mean, it's really nice. I only have 1 thing to think about. But, you know, Jerry Jones Direct is the company still. Been around for 22 years. So,
well done you.
Yeah. It's been crazy. I mean, I'd ask you the same question. How, Jesse, how did you go from dentist to practice management, entrepreneur, advising other dentists? How did you get, because that's not a lot of docs take that.
No, well, it's like your journey. It's full of twists and turns. And so I had my first business when I was 17 years old. So I was in high school and I started selling football jerseys to the kids at school. And I needed some money for this event we have here called Schoolies Week, which is, I think there must be some equivalent in the United States. It's kind of where the high school kids descend on the beach and essentially drink too much and do all
spring
the
break.
Spring break. Yeah. So I needed some cash for that. And so I started selling these football jerseys and got someone to design them and someone to go around and take the orders and do all that sort of stuff. And that turned out pretty well. But then, you know, I kind of settled down and went to university, did all that, joined the military after that, spent time at sea leading smaller teams and then larger teams, traveling around the world. And I had a really marvelous and wonderful time doing that. But in 2002, I left the Navy because I met a girl, as you do, and I left the Navy to come down to Canberra where my wife is from. And so we had babies and I took over the practice. And what ended up happening, Jerry, is I created myself this job. And so I didn't really have a business. I had a high-paid job. And I was happy on one hand because commercially and financially we were doing very well. And to anyone who looked in, yeah, it would have looked peaches and cream. But internally, I was dying because I had no spare time. I felt like that I was at the beck and call of my business. I was trying to do the dentistry by day and run the business by night. And to be honest with you, I burnt out. I was really a very unhappy camper at that particular time. So in a moment of insanity, we decided to sell everything and moved back to Brisbane, which is my hometown. And after the dust had settled for a little while and I kind of regained a bit of sleep and got things sorted out, I ended up going to marketing because I've always enjoyed marketing, and I started building websites. And this is going to sound particularly random, Jerry. I was building websites to sell ebooks and all sorts of ClickBank kind of products back in the day when that was a thing. And so do you remember that? Do you remember ClickBank?
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to admit it publicly, but I had a ClickBank account too, and I also was doing the same thing. So yes, I remember that.
Yeah. So
all too well.
Yeah, I know. And you know, the funny thing is out of that though, my friends from university said, hey, you know what a website needs to look like? You know how to get traffic to a website? You know what a crowd is? You know what a bridge is? Can you build us a practice website? So before too long, like you, I was doing some marketing as a done-for-you service, and like you, we could make the phone ring, and we knew that our marketing was working. We knew that that was all happening, but what ended up happening from there is the phone rang so much that the practice went under strain, and the systems fell apart, the team couldn't handle it, the leader was not keeping up with everything. And so really by, I wouldn't say 10 times in their business, but certainly multiplying their business, what it amplified was the little cracks, the little faults, little fault lines, I should say. And so it became a bit of a problem. So then from there, those same customers said to me, Jesse, we've got too many patients. How do I do this? How do I build a team? I need another dentist. I need to hire more people. Now I've got more people. It's really complicated. I thought I wanted new patients, but it turns out that that's just made other things more fragile. So that's really how it came about. And now we own another dental practice, but we do it differently, Jerry. We certainly have a much different approach to running that practice now, because I learned a lot more about leverage when I ran that internet marketing business. And as I said, we now have a business rather than a job. And that's been a key determinant for us. So yeah, like you, a bit of a roundabout path.
Yeah. Today. So you have a dental office then today, a practice today, right?
Yeah, we do.
So I don't know if your observation has been like mine. I mean, a dental practice today, or especially now where we're at here in mid 2018, I see really two extremes. I see small practice that is sort of Dr. Patty Lund would be the extreme one end, where it's like you don't even know he's there, and you have to have an invitation, and he serves tea and the biscuits that we talked about pre-show. That's one extreme where you can be really successful with a super high touch concierge type practice. I think I think that provides lifestyle, it provides income. And then on the other end, on the other extreme, there's the large practice, that is, it's got maybe you have multiple locations, but you certainly have a large staff. You have more than two doctors. You probably have 4, 5, 6, 10, 20 doctors. What do you think is happening to the middle? I mean, and I won't get into what's happening to the middle class in the U.S. because I think it's kind of similar, but what's going to happen to all these docs in the middle? Because we're kind of killing the middle, aren't we?
Yeah, look, I agree wholeheartedly. I assume there's some similar things happening in the United States. Here in Australia, we're seeing corporate roll-ups, concentration of ownership. The health insurance companies are buying up things. They're starting their own clinics. So what I'm seeing is exactly what you've said, is that middle ground is being lost, and you either need to really get a degree of scale or really get a really tight niche, and that you kind of need to go to one end of the bell curve or the other, but that middle ground is being eaten away by corporates, health insurance companies. And for me, I think if you want to play in that space, it's going to be a harder space because it's very competitive And from my observation, again, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this, mate. There seems to be a lot of pressure on margins. Certainly price is a consideration for many folk, and the race to the bottom in terms of we do it cheaper than the next dude seems to be a very common form of marketing from those large corporates. Is that something you've seen as well?
That's exactly right. I mean, that's the business model. And I think, that business model extends outside of dentistry. We're seeing it right now. I was just reading an article in the Wall Street Journal today about CVS. CVS is a huge pharmacy company. I mean, they have pharmacies, or I don't know if they have the equivalent in Australia, but it's where you would go to get prescriptions filled. And they might have, and they have other stuff there too, beer, wine, some light amount of bad snack foods and makeup and contact solution, Band-Aids, that kind of stuff.
I just love the idea that you can buy a beer with your prescription.
Well, shouldn't you have a beer with every prescription that you're taking? I mean, they used to sell cigarettes, but they got a conscience. I'm not kidding. They got a conscience and they stopped selling cigarettes.
Oh my goodness.
That's the darndest thing. So this company, what they're doing is they're putting the squeeze on all the independent pharmacies and doing it in such a way they're manipulating Medicare or government healthcare reimbursement rates. And they're manipulating them so that they're now so low, the independent pharmacist cannot survive. Only their larger pharmacies can survive. And so they're going in and they literally, this was in the article, they literally are having recruiters that work for the CVS pharmacy. They have recruiters that are going into the areas where CVS exists, and they know these guys are getting squeezed. These guys and gals are getting squeezed, and they are saying, hey, we understand what you're dealing with. I mean, business is tough and margins are shrinking, and you'd be better off just selling out to us. I mean, that's no joke. That's their recruiting strategy to purchase new, accounts, basically. So that business model is prevalent outside of dentistry, and the same thing is happening. You nailed it on the head. You can't live in the middle. You can't. I mean, you're going to die. And what do you tell these guys? I mean, I know what I tell them, but what kind of advice would you tell them? I mean, I'm in the middle. I'm a one doctor practice. I'm open 4 days a week or 3 days a week. I'm collecting $80,000 a month. I'm doing $1 million a year. I mean, what do you tell that guy? Because he thinks he's okay, or she.
Yeah, well, and they probably are at the moment, but it's an ever-changing landscape. And I don't think that ground is going to stay under their feet for too much longer. And so it's like everything. You've got to be able to survey the surrounds, take an assessment of what's happening, and adjust your strategy accordingly. But what I tell...
That's your military background speaking, isn't it?
Yeah, completely.
Yeah, I love it. No, I love it. I mean, they teach great leadership strategy and business strategy in the military. They do. Excellent.
Yeah. I think to quote a well-used marketing expression, there's riches in niches, right? Or we say niches here, but riches in niches. And so if you wanted to stay at that particular end, the Paddy Lund end of the spectrum, and I understand that Paddy is very much at one end of the spectrum, but if you wanted to be a more boutique, high-end, high-touchpoint kind of practice, then I'd say that's a space to move into, because I don't feel that the corporates are ever going to really cater to that segment of the market. It's certainly a smaller part of the market. But just as there's McDonald's and then there are five-star restaurants, there can be McDonald's dentistry and five-star dental practices. So I think there'll always be some consumers who want a high-touch experience. They care greatly about how they're treated, what their patient journey's like. And so I think, really, if you wanted to stay that solo style practice, you're going to need to think a little more strategically about where you move and what sort of market you're dealing with, and then create a marketing plan and, of course, the ability to deliver on that to suit that ideal patient avatar. So that would be my first thing. And coming back to the other side of the spectrum, you've spoken about the 4 to 5 docs and all the rest of it. I think you can get some leverage on that scale as well. But again, it's a tough landscape in that middle ground, and I think you just got to be a little bit mindful. And what's your experience in the United States with that, Jerry? What do you see happening? And the reason I ask you is because what happens in the United States typically happens in Australia a couple of years later. And so, what I love about observing the United States is we get a glimpse of our future. So I'm curious to see what's been your experience.
I think in this case, in dentistry in particular, we're actually lagging behind a bit. in this roll up. So about a year, I think it's been at least a year ago, I interviewed a dentist, and I can't remember his name. Thousands of dentists I talked to, and I can't remember his gentleman's name, but I had a great conversation with him, and we talked about this very topic. And from what he was sharing with me, it appeared that Australia was probably maybe 2-3 years ahead of us, maybe even as far as 5 years ahead of us, but probably not that far. So in this case, I was excited to get a glimpse of what I thought our future looked like. And at this point, I'm talking to a doctor a month that has sold their practice. And more than half of those doctors are selling to a group, a large group. And it could be one of the big companies like Heartland. It could be a smaller regional organization. But, you know, that business model is just so different than the solo practice model. And you go from being a dentist that has to have some minimal level of leadership skills and understanding of finance and marketing and business to someone who has to have all of those as their primary skills, and dentistry be damned. I mean, you don't need the dental skills. You just need the business skills. And so many doctors that I talk to that tell me, yeah, I'm going to hire an associate and then I'm going to open another location. And I'm sitting there thinking to myself, until you get your shit together at your current location, you shouldn't be thinking about anything else.
Amen to that. Thank you.
You're going to open 6 or 10 offices. I mean, you got to get your production up to about 250. You got to be open 6 days a week and have 3 doctors working 3 shifts a day in your current practice. Then somebody ought to talk to you about a second location.
Yeah, because there's all this hype around scaling, right? And I'm all for scaling. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not down on that. But what I think a lot of these guys come unstuck with, in my opinion anyway, and I'm not trying to be down on these guys either, but you've got to be careful what you scale. Because sometimes in that analogy you just used is you can scale crap. And when you scale crap, you just get more crap.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And the headaches compound. So if you already have 3 dental assistants you can't stand and 3 hygienists that you just as soon never see again, I'm going to open a second location so I can get away from these women. Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, you're going to go hire the same 5.
Because I'm insane. I'm a masochist and I want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. Like you, I feel the same thing about scaling. And that's sort of a buzzword. And everybody thinks they're going to get money from the private equity people and they're going to just scale and open a bunch of practices. I know some pretty sharp businessmen. I've got one in mind in particular. He has a couple of practices in Wisconsin. This guy's got it figured out. He's got 13 hygienists in 2 locations, 50, 60, I don't know how many employees he's got. He's got a bunch. They're doing big numbers. They've got economy of scale. They surround the town with their 2 practices. I mean, he's put a lot of thought, not coincidentally, he has an MBA and he did his thesis on the something about the proper management of PPOs in a fee-for-service environment or something like this. And that was done like 20 years ago. So he's been playing the PPO game for 20 plus years and they crush it. They just absolutely kill it. But he's a businessman. He's a dentist by skill set and training, but he's a business guy.
I really agree with that. And it's interesting because you touched on a topic that is near and dear to my heart, and that is the concept of regional domination. And the gentleman you just described, you said his practices surround the town. I'm curious to get your take on that, because I think if you were to, in inverted commas, own a location, I do think that's a good recipe for success in the right place. What do you think about that?
I agree. The way he set that up was intentional. He initially grew his practices through buy and merge. And so he would buy a practice in an area where he wanted to be, and he would merge it, or he would move his existing practice to the better location. So he's just always had his eyes out for that particular strategy. And he knew that's what he wanted. I'm going to need 2 offices so that when I can no longer practice, I can still pull down a mid 6-figure-a-year salary, or whatever it is he makes. He does it very well. I saw his brand new house that was paid for in cash. So I can, on the shores of Lake Michigan. So I can tell you he does very well. I mean, I think that's a great strategy. It makes sense. You can use advertising that you're mailing in one part of this community to be effective in multiple parts of the community. If I were going to do it all over again, I would take a similar approach rather than just 1 office. I'd open a couple. I think it's a strategy that makes sense. I wrote down a note that said location is important. when you were talking about, you know, doctors that they need to sort of decide if they're going to be what end of the spectrum they're going to be on, because being in the middle is just dangerous and it's going to get more so as time goes on. If you want to go that high touch or the Dr. Patty Lund route, which I admire the daylights out of that guy. He's got cojones. He is smart and he's got brass balls, as they say. Somebody like that gets what they deserve. And he's just, you know, sounds like he's done a phenomenal job, but you have to be in the right area. You can't pull off something like that, a high touch, high fee concierge type practice in a location where the average income is below the national poverty level. You just can't do it. So location becomes important. So you have to have congruency with your plan and reality, which I don't mean to keep talking, Jesse, but I was reading a book that was written by a billionaire, and he was talking about one of the secrets to his success has been understanding reality and not what people believe is reality. In other words, he's had a very accurate picture of what reality looks like. And he said that has been one of the keys to his success, is just not getting sucked into trends, into false deities, false gods, false economic data. I mean, this guy, he says, I live in reality. And that's one of the reasons why I've been successful. I'm very careful about who I listen to and what I listen to. And I think there's a lot of value in that. Just that simple thought.
Yeah. And I guess the thing is, sometimes though, it is hard. And I don't know if you agree with this or not, but sometimes it's hard to sift through what is real and what is story. Did he provide any insights as to how he's been able to keep his feet firmly planted on the ground? Was there an insight around that? Or was it just he's got this innate ability to kind of see through the noise and get to the heart of the matter?
He mentioned looking for, how did he put it? I'm trying to remember how he put it exactly, but I'll use the word again, congruent. So facts that were congruent. So as an example, let's say we're reading a report that says unemployment is down, but yet we're looking around and we see all these people without jobs. Then you got to question to yourself, how in the world is unemployment down if I'm visually seeing more people that are not working? Well, come to find out, we've reclassified what unemployment means. And so the public doesn't pay attention to those kinds of things, right? Now, here in the States, that's exactly what happened during a number of years is the U.S. Department of Employment changed how they defined unemployment and who qualified to be defined as unemployed. And when they did that, magically enough, the statistics improved. And so this guy would look at that and go, well, the evidence is showing something totally different than what the storyline is. So I'm going with the evidence and to hell with the storyline. And I think dentists need to look around and understand that most of the time, whether they're talking to colleagues or they're talking to someone that's trying to sell them something, they need to do their own independent analysis and really just ask themselves, is this a fairy tale? Is this reality? Am I just being a sucker? Am I being gullible? Because this doesn't seem like it's true, or it could be true. It's kind of like the guy that says, the salesman that'll tell you, you know, oh, we can get you all the patients you need, 100 new patients a month. 200. No, it's like, you got to read the fine print. And then you need to also go and find a half dozen people that can vouch that that's true and look at their statistics, actually see the stats. Most of us don't do that. We're lazy. We're looking for shortcuts. We're looking for the easy button, as they say. And there isn't an easy button.
I really like that as well, because it comes back to everyone's looking for a silver bullet. If I pay this marketing guy or girl X dollars a month, then I've done my bit and their job is now to give me 100 new patients a month. And of course, it doesn't always pan out that way. What I'm really interested in talking about was data. You spoke about looking at the evidence. And one of the things that's a common phrase that we hear in dentistry over in Australia is evidence-based dentistry, evidence-based medicine, all that sort of thing. And what I'm always curious about is we're so willing to look for evidence in our clinical day-to-day procedures, you know, why we do what we do from a clinical standpoint. But there are so many practice owners flying by the seat of their pants without any data to make decisions. And it feels like they're flying blind. Yeah, they've got this cockpit. They're in an F-16 flying at Mark 3 with a blindfold on and, you know, hoping they don't crash. And I guess what I wanted to ask you around that, Jerry, is what do you see as the key data points to really keep an eye on in a practice? You've obviously had the experience of owning a business. You've also had the experience of helping many dentists with their business in terms of marketing and other things as well. What do you see as the key data points or the key bits of evidence we should be looking for?
I think there's a couple of different answers. There's the marketing side, and then there's, you know, the actual business side, even though, you know, marketing is part of the business. If I can, I'll start in the business and I'll maybe just share what I looked at. So, you know, coming at this from the standpoint of I was 100% unable to influence in any way production. The minute that I would talk to a dentist about, hey, you know, you're really not producing what we need you to produce, or why did you do this 3 surface filling when we could have done a crown? I never, ever one time had that conversation. Anytime a dentist would come to me and ask, I want to talk about a case, I just said, you know, I can't talk about this. It's really nothing I can add. And, you know, you just need to trust your professional judgment or go ask a colleague, because it's nothing I can do. So I couldn't influence the big thing in dentistry, which is production, right? I mean, without any production, you got squat. So all I could do is just put patients in the practice and hire what I thought were good people to help run the business. And so my perspective of this is totally different than what the average dentist is going to be. So I looked every day. I got a copy of the day sheet. And so Dentrix, we use Dentrix software, and I'd get a copy of the day sheet faxed to me along with deposits, adjustments, you know, all those kinds of things, all the reports that come from wrapping up a day. And I looked at what was our ratio of production to collection. I looked at numbers of new patients. And then I scanned the day sheet to make sure that, A, it was accurate, that there weren't mispostings. Sometimes, you know, like maybe an exam got credited to a hygienist and it should have been credited to the dentist. I mean, those kinds of things. So I just scanned it really quick. It'd take me maybe 5 minutes at most. But I was looking for making sure that our deposits were hitting the baseline every day, at least what we needed to cover our overhead for the day. And I could tell you our overhead to the dollar on a monthly basis. In 2017, it was about $48,350. In 2018, for the first 5 months and 10 days that I owned it, we had ratcheted that overhead down to about $45,500 a month. And that's a 4-day a week dental office. So that's a pretty low overhead for those folks who know anything about, you know, what it costs to run their practice.
Yeah, it's good. It's tight.
Yeah, it's very tight. I mean, we had no frills, no bells and whistles. We certainly were not running a skeleton crew or anything, but we were just very careful and very prudent. I mean, after 15 years, you kind of figure some of that stuff out. And so I looked at production collections and that ratio, and I knew based on history what that ratio should be. And what I'm looking for there is if we produce, say we produce 100,000, we should be collecting and depositing into the bank at least 82,000 at a minimum. So we're right around that 82 to 85% production to collections ratio. So, you know, I knew that every dollar that we did in production, we should be depositing between 82 and 85 cents into the bank. So I watched that like a hawk, because I knew if there was a problem that it was going to show there. So, you know, if I saw that our deposits were down, that told me a couple of things. Number one, nobody's asking for the money, and they should be asking for the money, and they shouldn't be embarrassed. By the way, one of the best front office people you can hire is a bartender or someone that has worked in food service, because they're not afraid to ask for the money. They're perfectly comfortable. And so we had the last gal that I hired for the front office was a bartender, and she was a little rough when we first got her as an employee, but, you know, over time she became very polished, and our collections were the strongest they'd ever been during that period of time when I, you know, before I sold the business. So I look at that ratio. I also look at numbers of new patients. I know, you know, instinctively over 15 years, you kind of figure out how many new patients you need a month based on the doctor load. So I'd make sure that we had at least that many calling and making appointments. I looked at appointment to call ratios. So if we're generating 100 phone calls, we should have X number of appointments. You know, we should have, if it's a new patient opportunity, we should be at least booking 83% or 84% of new patient phone calls. So that was a number I looked at. And we measured all those. I looked at our profit and loss statement every single Monday morning without fail, and our balance sheet. So I was pretty in on accounts receivable. We watched that like a hawk. And I had a business partner in the dental office, and that was really where he focused a lot of his attention on, was the AR. And so we watched that AR. We kept it usually within 30 days to 45 days of production. So as an example, you know, our AR, if we were producing 100 grand a month, our AR never exceeded 150. but I'm more comfortable with it being about 80, you know, a little less than 1 month of production. So we charged late fees and we charged interest, and that helped our patients prioritize paying us. We used auto draft or auto debit, ACH, you know, to make sure we're getting payments, credit cards, whatever. And so, you know, those were the big things that I watched. And there are so many statistics that you can pay attention to, like what's your hygienist doing a day? Ours were pretty consistent at about 1500 a day. I talked to a dentist the other day and his hygiene department was doing 400 a day. And I said, what are those folks doing all day long? I mean, how can they only be doing $400 a day? So, you know, I mean, things like that, and doctor production per hour, we would occasionally look at it just to see, make comparisons with past doctors that we'd had or whatever. That was pretty much it. I mean, you know, you can run the business if you're paying attention to those key metrics. And like I said, there's so many others to analyze and look at, but those are what I used really on a 30,000 foot view looking in. That's what I used to, you know, to make sure that we were on track. But like I said, you can analyze it to death.
Well, you certainly can. And there's no shortage of data, is there? There's endless amounts of data that you can look at and analyze. I'm curious just to quiz you a little bit, because I suspect there might be some regional differences here between the United States and Australia. But I just wanted to uncover the collection and invoiced difference. Yeah, I think you said 83 or 82% was what you collected on what you produced. Where did the other 17 or 18% go? Was that in AR, or was that in discounts, or was that in insurance rebates, or what was the gap?
That's a great question. The majority of those are going to be insurance discounts and new patient discounts. A new patient would walk into our practice, and instead of spending $300, $300 on a new patient exam and a prophy, we had a new patient exam offer for $39, and that would just be a comprehensive exam only. And then 9 times out of 10, they would upgrade and add a cleaning at a bit of a reduced discount. Not much of a reduced discount on the cleaning, but just a little bit. Mostly to get them to schedule and experience our office. That was, you know, that was the whole goal. It's to get them in the door. When you run 80, 90 patients through, or 50 patients through, and you're knocking off $200 on every new patient exam, that adds up quick. Yeah. And then you've got insurance discounts. So if you we were a preferred provider, a PPO with Delta, which is the 800-pound gorilla here in the States.
Yeah, we've got one here too.
Yeah, right. They're everywhere. There's one everywhere. And so we would end up writing off a bit from that as well. But that was the only insurance company we were ever contracted with, other than we did for a period of time some national healthcare plan. And that was a very, very low reimbursement, you know, literally a third of what our normal fees were. So we did that for a while. That was an interesting experience. And then we eventually just killed it all together and got off of that. But that was massive discounts there. I mean, you're talking huge discounts. So that's where that difference comes from. And so for us, most of the doctors here in the States are around the 85 percentile. Their collections ratio, production collections ratio is about 85%.
So. Okay, cool. Ours would be a little higher than that. And of course, it varies depending on the relationship with insurance companies and so on. So in a non-preferred provider arrangement, you know, the collection and invoicing is almost the same. But when you're discounting through various rebates and whatnot, then typically it drops down to 90, 95, 94, around that kind of space. But that's not a huge difference. I wanted to just ask you then, because if you've got this difference between collection and invoicing, then coming to a pet topic that you and I both have is retention. It becomes really critically important then to retain those patients, right? Because over time, as they begin to know you, like you, and trust you, that's really where the discretionary spend comes. It may not come in that first visit. So the retention maths becomes important, because year on year, as the relationship with the practice grows, their likelihood of accepting treatment increases and revenue follows. Would you agree with that concept?
I would agree 100%. And that is a point where, unfortunately, a lot of docs fall short-sighted. And I think some of it is because they haven't been trained to understand, or they haven't been exposed to the concepts, the simple concept that you just talked about. And it's one of the reasons why, you know, doctors would come to me and they'd ask, hey, should I join a PPO, or should I join this PPO, or should I just remain fee-for-service? There's a lot of consideration that a doctor should make before they dive into a PPO relationship and sign that contract. But they've got to understand that my perspective is always this: an insurance company's job, in my mind, is to bring me a patient. It's marketing. I'm going to give that patient a discount because the insurance company brought them to me. I'm going to give them a discount on this group of services, but there's a whole other group of services that I don't have to discount that the insurance company doesn't cover. And if I can help that patient understand the value of getting those other services, then that's where I'm going to make my big money. And most docs just haven't grasped that concept. It's a short, it seems to be, to me, often to be a short-sighted vision. In other words, they're only looking at transaction one and two. They're not looking at what we call the lifetime value of that patient, which brings me a question that I'd love to have you answer at some point, is kind of, you know, what your thoughts are on the lifetime value of a patient is in Australia versus the US. And because to me, the longer that relationship lasts, now we're talking retention, the more value that relationship brings to me in the bottom line. But also, I mean, just from the, is the word altruistic, just from that relationship, just from a human interaction, enjoyment, fun relationship,
isn't it? Yeah. Standpoint,
right? Enjoyment. It comes later in the relationship. It's like when you first marry your love of your life, it's a fun thing and it's all exciting and, you know, it's, you know, whatever newlyweds do, all that good stuff. To me, the value in relationships comes later. Like the relationship that my wife and I have after 20 years is so much more powerful with time, and it gets stronger with time and with age. And I think about just standard run-of-the-mill everyday relationships with patients, and those improve and solidify. And we make deposits. I call this, I have this concept that I discuss in retention about emotional equity. I call it E². So we develop this emotional equity with our patients over years of interaction. And this intimate, it's a very intimate thing, you know, when you're working on a patient, you're in their mouth. And I mean, you're all up in their face, literally.
Yeah, literally, yeah.
And they're allowing you. They're, right, they're just laying there and they're allowing you to be that close to them. There's bound to be some strong bonds formed because of the trust level. And so we really aren't able to take advantage of the equity that relationship, that emotional equity that relationship builds until later, nor should we be able to take advantage of that until a future date, right? I mean, that's how relationships are supposed to work. It's give and take, it's time. So for me, when I think of retention, the longer you can keep a patient interested in you, and at least the perception that you're interested in them, the better it is, not just for them, but for you as well. And the healthier it is for your practice. There's just not enough emphasis put on patient retention. And that's unfortunate, because to me, that's where all the money's at. And by the way, we actually are able now to prove that that's where the money's at in a piece of software we just literally finished up about a week ago. So anyway.
So it's a really interesting thing, Jerry, because like you, I'm sure you get questions like me where it's a case of, Jerry, should I be running a direct mail campaign, or do you think I should be running a Facebook ad, or should I be on Snapchat or Instagram? And all of those tactical questions that come up all the time, because again, we're looking for that, you know, easy button or the silver bullet. And for me, I was running a webinar last night, and one of the things that came up was one of our newer clients was asking about Facebook campaigns. So it's a really legitimate question. There's nothing wrong with the question. But my go-to answer, and as unsexy as this sounds, is to always plug the retention leaks first. Because until you do that, the marketing efforts you end up doing in an external manner, whether it's direct mail or Facebook or, you know, whatever, they're largely wasted, or they're potentially wasted, because we're opening the front door really widely to welcome new people in, but we're equally letting the back door stay open and people are exiting, and it becomes, in some cases, a zero-sum game, and it just seems pointless.
Well, I mean, you nailed it on the head. I don't have anything else to add to that, because, I mean, you literally nailed it on the head, because to me, you're right. I would only plus what you said by saying, until you plug the holes in the bucket and stop the people walking out the back door and finding out why they're leaving. I mean, look, the only reason someone should ever leave Dr. Green's practice is if they're dead or they move out of town. And if they move out of town, it better be like a plane ride away. Otherwise, they better get their butt in their car and show up in your practice, right? But see, nobody has that deep conviction that I am not going to lose a patient no matter what. I've talked to one dentist in 22 years, one dentist, and interestingly enough, he's now become a fairly well-known practice management guy. He's opened 14 dental offices in his life, and he's sold a huge chunk of that. of his organization to a big DSO, a dental services organization, one of the corporates. And I mean, he doesn't pull any punches about why he did it or what he's doing. But I did a podcast show with him, and I asked him, I said, well, what do you do when a patient leaves your practice? He goes, I know every single patient that leaves every one of my 14 practices, and I know why they left. I said, you know what, Doc, you are the first person I've ever talked to that could answer that question. He's got it. I mean, if somebody leaves, you damn well better know why they left, and you better fix it if you can. It's that important, which kind of brings me around to the question of lifetime value. I mean, what have you sort of either estimated or have hard facts on? What is the lifetime value of a patient to an Australian dental practice?
Well, I think it's more of an estimate rather than a hard fact because, again, I would say there's some variability from practice to practice. But in the people that I work with, the lifetime value is certainly in the tens and tens of thousands of dollars, multiple tens of thousands of dollars, because typically if whatever age they join your practice, if, let's say someone joins your practice in their mid-30s, typically by the time they're in their 40s, they're starting to need some restorative work. So there's some units of crown and bridge, maybe a root canal, something goes awry, maybe an implant or a bridge. But certainly I would suggest it's well over $10,000, probably closer to upwards of 20 grand, and maybe even more for some people. But the thing that I really feel that I've got a better measure on rather than lifetime value is a shorter time frame, which the lifetime value thing I really use a lot, but what I use more is the five-year value, because for me that gives me a start and end point. And for us, the five-year value, and I can tell you very candidly in our practice, the five-year value for our patients is certainly in that $15,000 mark on average, and that's significant. But most of that spend comes in years 4 and 5.
Oh man, so if you weren't taking care of those folks, you would not be seeing that type of lifetime value.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, not every single patient is going to need that kind of work, but the principle is the same. And here's the other thing too, Jerry, is A, not only if you don't take care of that patient, you're not going to see that kind of work, but B, you're going to miss the referrals that come from that patient as well. So it's a double-edged sword. If you get this right, your practice can grow exponentially in terms of revenue, but equally in terms of patient flow. And so my big thing is if you're going to run an external marketing campaign, you know, whether it's direct mail, Facebook, AdWords, you know, whatever, for me, I'm always wanting to turn that one patient into multiple patients. I want to get my cost of acquisition much lower. And so for me, the internal marketing really is a multiplier. And so that's really what we focus on. Yes, we do external marketing, but the emphasis is always saying, okay, if we're going to get one patient from AdWords, I want to turn that one patient into three.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you're right about, we call it PAC, patient acquisition cost. And when we look at a practice that has rather high acquisition cost, I mean, the next thing we ask them is talk to me about your referrals. Because if you don't have the interest or the knowledge or understanding of what retention means, you're not going to be getting the referrals you should be getting. You're not asking for them. You have no systems in place. You're not doing a monthly newsletter. You're not whatever, all the 101 things we can do. You're missing out on not only lowering your patient acquisition cost by cutting it at least in half or in thirds or tenths or whatever. You're just leaving money on the table and you're costing yourself a fortune that isn't necessary. It is. It's refreshing to talk to someone that gets this. And it's so sad because, I mean, most doctors don't think beyond that initial year of transactions. And so one of the things we're focused on here is at Jerry Jones Direct is showing them through our software. By the way, I don't know if this name is going to stick or not, but the software we developed, we're calling it Truth Serum.
I love that.
I mean, it's showing exactly what's going on. I mean, basically, it starts with call monitoring and then all the data that we gather from that and then production data and collection. You know, anyway, it's quite fascinating. But in this software, we can show them the value of a single patient, not just in 40, 60, and 90 days, but in years. And I like your idea. So like your lifetime value, you know, say in a period of 5 years. I love that, the defined period of time. And that's sort of how I measured it in my dental office. And we would look at a five-year period and look at referrals. You know, I mean, you can't do that with every single patient that walks in the door, but it wasn't uncommon for every fifth patient to refer at least two people. When you look at statistics like that, you realize how fast you can grow. If you plug the holes in the bucket and you really pay attention and focus on retention and referrals, it's a no brainer.
It is. It makes a huge amount of sense. Hey Jerry, we've covered a lot of territory today. We've gone uphill and down dale, and mate, I wanted to as we begin to wrap up our conversation today, I wanted to ask you, knowing what you know now, going because you know, you've had that experience of owning a dental practice, and of course, listen, there'll be plenty of docs listening to this show from either your end or our end. If you had to have a billboard where you said the gospel according to Jerry, what would be the two or three things that you would say to docs as they're going about their practice ownership journey to really make it worthwhile and work for them so they create true wealth for themselves, they create great experiences for their patients, and of course, they get to do the work that they enjoy, they get to have that sweet spot. What would be one or two things that you would say to the guys and girls listening that would make a difference to them on their day-to-day journey?
It's not about you. That would be one.
Wow. That's really powerful too.
You are not your patient. And to go deeper into that one is you don't know what your patients want. And so you better ask them because you're a dentist and you don't know. So, you know, you're not your patient. The third one I might throw up there, be curious.
That's really, really important.
I look at where I've grabbed my biggest breakthroughs. I mean, I can't take credit for any of them. I've stolen every great idea I've ever had. And whoever gave it to me stole it from somebody else. And so curiosity has been a huge, I think it's made a huge impact, just being curious. You asked me earlier a question after I'd made a statement, and I thought it was a very smart question. And it was about the billionaire, you know, did he go into how he measured reality or what, you know, what he, you know, you sort of asked a follow-up question. And I thought, well, that's the right next question. It isn't going on to whatever thought you had next. It was diving deeper into something of value and showing curiosity. I think oftentimes dentists aren't curious enough about things outside their wheelhouse, outside their comfort zone. Because in reality, I mean, dentistry is such a tiny, tiny slice of anyone's life that is not a dentist. I think by being curious and opening yourself up to things outside of your comfort zone will make you a better dentist, and they're going to make you definitely a better communicator and business person.
I really resonate with that, mate. And interestingly enough, you mentioned that your good ideas, you know, you've borrowed from other people, and it's the same with me. And I have to tell you that just about every good idea I've ever had for my dental practice has come from outside of dentistry as well.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The dental profession is wonderful and I'm eternally grateful to it, but there is so much wisdom and so many insights to be had from other businesses and other industries that are directly applicable to our own. And I think sometimes we could cast our gaze a little further afield and look for those ideas and pinch them and make them our own.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more.
Cool.
For sure.
Hey, Jerry, you have been incredibly generous with your time and your wisdom and your insights and your knowledge. And, mate, I have to say this has been one of the most fun podcasts and enjoyable conversations I've had for a long time. And I mean that with all sincerity because I've had some tremendous guests on my show and I'm grateful to all of them. And this one has been a lot of fun. So thank you. I have really enjoyed our conversation today.
I have as well. And it always is more exciting and interesting when you talk to someone who sort of understands where you're coming from. And you definitely, you know, I feel like you get me and I certainly get where you're coming from. It's been an enjoyable time for me as well. And I've just had a blast.
Yeah. Thank you, mate. Listen, I really appreciate it. And let's catch up. And must I tell your daughter when she's making those Anzac biscuits, save some for us because they're delicious.
I will tell her. I'm actually looking forward to going in and having one here in just a few minutes.
Well, enjoy that, mate. Enjoy it.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.